So I'm driving along the A1, listening to the Proclaimers, and the tears are streaming down my face. When you go back, will you send a letter from America? My big girl was going off for a year to America to study, and I hated the thought of saying goodbye. And that song just caught the mood of loss and separation, and before I could stop them, the teardrops were running down my face. I don't know about you, but I hate goodbyes. I'm fine right up until the person who's leaving disappears behind the barrier and all the jokes and the hugs and the cheerios, and then they're gone, lost among the crowds, and there's emptiness and lonesomeness. Emptiness and lonesomeness. I hate goodbyes. Farewell speeches are always tricky. I remember listening to a friend who'd been made redundant, making his farewell speech, and he did it with great dignity and charity. And not a little emotion. The people around him in the Conan Doyle pub at his farewell do had been part of his life for 27 years. And there was real pain in the parting. An exciting new phase was beginning for him and for them without him. Goodbyes are always tricky, poignant. Jesus had made it clear to his followers that he would not always be present for them, as he had been during the 3.5 years or so of their travels together and his teaching ministry among them. The series of resurrection appearances that had so convinced them of his victory over sin and death had reached its conclusion. For 40 days, that wonderful symbolic period of time. In Bible code, it traditionally marked the end of one thing and the beginning of something else. He had confirmed them in their assurance that indeed nothing could overcome the power of his life and his love. But now they would see him no more. Poignant, painful, scary. How would it all work out? How would they cope? He'd given them such a task to fulfil, such a vision to chase, they could never manage. He assures them that although he will not be present with them in his visible form, his physical presence anymore, his living spirit would be among them and within them, and they would have the words to say and the power to triumph, the courage to be faithful, even unto death. It would be as if, no matter where they were, before a powerful emperor, or huddled in the sand and blood of the Colosseum, his presence was with them, unseen yet as significant as the breath they breathed, as real as the invisible wind that rustled the barley. They listened and wondered. So this was it. This was the final appearance, the last goodbye. They described it as best they could in the words and images of the ancient dramas, where a symbolic cloud expressed the presence of God and the glory of his nearness unfolds again. Like the cloud of the presence of God way back then in the desert with the pilgrim people of Israel struggling their way to the promised land. Or like the glory of God on Mount Sinai when Moses receives the law. It was like the mountain of transfiguration where the closest disciples catch a glimpse of the glory of Christ in the cloud and in the mystery. All of this echoed in the enfolding cloud that shrouded the mountaintop and heralded the end of Christ's earthly ministry, the beginning of a new thing for the church, his church. This account, particular to Luke's gathered material, makes the point with force that whatever it's going to be like for the disciples of Jesus, from now on, it's going to be different. In other parts of the story, Jesus makes it clear that, in fact, what seems like a tragedy, his absence from them in the flesh, is in fact going to be a blessing, for his Holy Spirit will be with them and in them, sharing his life with them, wherever they are, in whatever location or crisis they find themselves. He will be with them always, for his Spirit will dwell in their hearts, and it will be just as if they had Jesus' company on the way, if they're in Jerusalem or Jedburgh, Perth, Australia, or Cape Town, South Africa, whether it's the year 223 or the year 2023. His followers will know him near, time and space no longer constraining his love, no longer limiting its reach, moving from the local to the global, and his power and presence will enrich their journey of faith and be a blessing to them, wherever, whenever. but he must go. The affirming, reassuring, confirming experiences of the risen Lord, they will cease. He must return to the Father, but he will be with them as his Spirit breathes in their soul. And then he is gone. And because their worldview, their idea of how the universe was organized, was that God was up there somewhere, up beyond our world, though surely even beyond that, before anything that the idea of up can describe, beyond that, they gaze for one last lingering look, hoping for one final glimpse, the deepest desire to hold on to what they had rather than embrace what they don't know and hardly dare contemplate. We none of us like goodbyes. And we don't need to make too much about the poetry of the dramatic devices of the cloud and the looking up and the men in white with their encouragement to the disciples to move on, to get the church ready for the high task to which it was called. The story of Jesus on Ascension Day disappearing into the cloud was simply a reminder of the glory of God that surrounded him in those special moments. And the looking up is an understandable symbol of that sense of the majesty and the otherness of God. That's how they described it, as the king is returning to his throne. That's the impact of the picture. That's what we're supposed to get from the poetry. And if you go into one of the great cathedrals, you'll see how they try to capture that sense with their fabulous frescoes of the kingly Christ and all his majesty high above the altar, his work of salvation completed, his triumph secure, surrounded by dramatic images of glory and power. Well, that's not how we do it in the simple, low-key dignity of the Auditoire de Calvin, but it's certainly how they do it at St. Paul's or Liverpool Cathedral. But best not to imagine him rising into the clouds like a levitating David Blaine. It's not about direction, it's about departure. It's simply the New Testament's way of recognising that he's gone from this realm, with its physicality and its limitations, to be with his Father in a glory that is beyond this world, beyond our notions or our definitions. No need to get hung up on ancient theories about the shape of the universe or old mythologies about where the world was in relation to where heaven is. Let's just say he's left this world with its restrictions for the splendor he let go of when he come from the glory, he come from the glorious kingdom. The message, though, is clear. His followers are not to be in the business of holding on to past glories and old securities. They are now in the spirit business of serving God and spreading his truth in the power of Christ, in the name of Christ, sustained and strengthened by his inner life pulsing and bubbling within their hearts. They could stand there all day trying to keep hold of the old safeties and the old certainties, but that was not their calling now. Instead, they were to go out into that dangerous and unwelcoming world and tell the story of his victory and preach the gospel of his love with the power of his Spirit sustaining them, burning like a fire in their hearts. It was strange. It was disturbing. It was beyond words. As well it might have been. It was certainly inescapably the end of one part of the story and the beginning of another. See, for Luke and the other gospel writers, there is the compelling question. How do you describe the end of the never-ending story? How do you explain the truth that he isn't going to be around anymore in the way he used to be, and yet he is going to be there for them in a way that will enrich and bless, empower and inspire his church? How do you demonstrate to the early church that he has passed the baton on to his people, to us, heaven help us, for us to be his voice, his hands, his compassion, his truth-bearers? And in that high calling, as we try to fulfill that high calling, he will accompany us into the challenge, the risk, the sacrifices that will be part of all of that. The other gospel writers deal with the ending in a range of ways. Mark finishes with the resurrection. Simple. There. Done. Matthew has the mountaintop farewell and the commission to his disciples to go into all the world with the gospel, and the assurance that he will be with them always to the end of time. John shows Jesus in a deep and meaningful conversation with his disciples on the sleepy shores. but it's Luke. Luke, who's taken great trouble to gather the facts as he has found them, who gives us this fuller account and leaves us in no doubt that it's over and yet it's just beginning. The new order pertains. A new situation faces the followers of Jesus in every generation, in every location, without him in the flesh, yet with him in the spirit. Intriguing and mysterious and certainly scary. It's as if they've served their apprenticeship and now they are entrusted with the task of taking the faith into all the world. Mission impossible. Mission impossible. Were it not that the Lord is with them, in their heads, in their hearts, in their togetherness, in the praise they bring, the prayers they offer, the power they will demonstrate at the table as they share bread and wine. They don't need to worry. Success will not depend on their eloquence, not even on their courage. He will give them the words to say. His spirit will shake and stir the hearts of men and women. They will hear the voice of Christ call them from darkness into light, from death to life. He is loose in the world. Do not be afraid. I am with you always. And so it happened. So it happened. We are here to demonstrate that. Across the world, across the centuries, across the cultures. The Spirit of Jesus Christ keeps the church alive, explains its existence, dares its mission, calls men and women still to follow him. That's the story. This Ascension Day.